From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. This week, The Exchange goes in-depth, looking at mental health care in New Hampshire. It's a system once viewed as top-notch, but that has eroded over the past two decades to the point where a 2013 court settlement forced the state to make improvements and to submit to regular reviews. Now, almost 5 years later, is it better? That's what we'll ask all this week on The Exchange. Today, we begin with an overview, and later in the hour, our Race for the First series continues as we introduce you to the many candidates running for the first congressional district. Today, it's Democrat Mark McKenzie. As always, let's hear from you. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. With me in studio, Katya Fox. She's director of the Division for Behavioral Health at New Hampshire's Department of Health and Human Services. And Katya, it's nice to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Good morning.
Also with us, Ken Norton, executive director of NAMI-NH. That's the National Alliance on Mental Illness. And Ken, welcome back. Good to see you, too.
Great to be back.
Well, Ken, so is it better? Is the state's mental health system better today than it was, you know, 4.5 years ago or so when this settlement was signed?
It's a really difficult question. And I think that for a lot of people that are using the system right now, the answer would be no.
Really?
Well, when we're looking at the numbers of people waiting in emergency rooms and people kind of stacked up in crisis, the answer is no. But it's the less visible, the answer is definitely yes. And those are people that are receiving housing supports through the mental health settlement agreement, mobile crisis response in three communities in Concord, Manchester, and Nashua, and other supports as well. And I think that some of the steps that have been taken since the settlement agreement are definitely moving us in the right direction. And again, those aren't necessarily visible, but planning for the 10-year plan and legislation moving different pieces forward, the children's system of care, all those things are definitely better.
So that's interesting, Ken. So it sounds like systemically, there are some things going on that you feel positive about, but in terms of just basic measurements, numbers, people waiting, people needing, those aren't necessarily better.
And those are the most visible pieces of the system, I think.
And the human pieces of
absolutely.
It.
Absolutely.
People suffering.
And when we talk about the settlement agreement, it was only about adults, so it didn't include children. And it also, while it does speak to individuals who are incarcerated with mental illness, it doesn't really go very in-depth there, and that's also a less visible but still very challenging and important piece of the mental health system.
Well, and you're setting up the rest of this series really well, because tomorrow in the series we're going to be looking at children and youth, and then on Wednesday we will look at the intersection of mental health and the criminal justice system. Katya, what about you? What do you think? What's better and what isn't?
So I appreciate Ken's comments. What I think that we need to do is look back a little bit farther and to 2008. So in 2008 is when the last 10-year mental health plan was put into place. Fast forward 10 years and think about what happened over that period of time. So we had a recession hit and we had funding issues. And so we had an erosion of the infrastructure of the system that people are relying on. So since that time, we've had the opportunity, and we really have an opportunity right now, to invest in that infrastructure and to rebuild the system. And so what we've been able to do is to put in the supports and the community supports that are really needed that we hope and know will make a difference in the future. So that infrastructure development is ongoing. It's happening now as a result of a lot of efforts by a lot of people. And I think that we will start to see a difference when we talk about individuals.
Well, and in a minute, I want to ask both of you what that infrastructure really is, especially for people who don't interact with the system day to day. But speaking of the commitment, Katya, we got an email from a listener, didn't give his or her name, but this person says, the problems facing the mental health system aren't unsolvable. They just need to be made a priority by the legislature. This person asks, what will it take to make that happen? And I want to thank this person for submitting his answer her question. What do you think, Katya?
Well, I think under the leadership of Commissioner Myers from HHS, as well as our governor and our legislature, there is a commitment, and that commitment is being demonstrated through funding. So we had funding through the budget and through HB 400 and 517, which was the budget bill last year. There were serious dollars that were invested into the system, including housing supports, which are so important. We just had another session that wrapped up, and there were additional investments in allowing us to be more flexible in the funding that we do have so that we can meet those needs. So there's plenty of opportunity, and I think there is commitment. I think we have people like Chief Justice Broderick who are putting a real face to this and addressing the stigma issues. And we have Ken Norton, who has been steadfast and is really, his voice is being heard, and some of his efforts are paying off.
One of the things that I've heard, Ken, I've heard other people say what Katya is saying, is that there are more resources from the legislature now, that this is a better moment in terms of funding, but that there just aren't the professionals to provide the care. So maybe there's funding, maybe a person actually has the dollars that it takes to seek care, but he or she can't find a provider.
Workforce capacity is a huge issue right now, not just in the mental health system, but
everywhere.
Across healthcare and everywhere. I mean, when we have an unemployment rate of, you know, below 2.5%, it's a challenge. And I think one of the things that's very difficult when the conundrums about having a series like this, when we talk about all of the challenges that the system faces, is that how do we message to young people that there are great jobs and just wonderful, fulfilling professions by working with people with serious mental illness? And, you know, there are certainly challenges, and it is difficult work, but it is wonderful work. And I think that that's an important message that we need to get out.
So make the case then, because a lot of other sectors are also making that case. Hey, it's a great time to work in manufacturing. Hey, it's a great time to work in tourism. So how do you sort of cut through that, Ken, and say to a young person, this is why you should do this, even though it's going to be emotionally challenging, I'm guessing, and maybe the pay isn't great?
Well, I guess I have to answer that on a personal question and just say that, you know, that I've had just an amazing career, and I've been in people's homes. I've been in maternity units. I've been in funeral homes. I've been in prison. I've been in jail. I've seen people at their worst. I've been to graduations. I've been, you know, involved in people's lives in a way that I wouldn't otherwise, that has really helped me grow personally and helped me with raising my family. And I've been able to, you know, not get rich, but certainly lead a middle-class lifestyle and be a much better person than I was before I got into the mental health field.
Well, one more question about funding. Katya, I have read that the community mental health centers in the state are still reimbursed by the state 2006 levels? That was a long time ago. So all this funding that you talked about, is some of that going to go to ramp that up?
Actually, that is something that we are looking at. We're working very closely with New Hampshire Community Behavioral Health Association and taking a look at those rates, because we do know that the rates are set from 2006. We are working with our actuary to see what it would mean to make further investments. But yes, very much so. That's something that we need to do.
And who sets those rates? Is it the state or the feds? Because I know Medicaid is a state and federal match.
So the state sets the rates, and those need to be actuarially sound through a process for our managed care program.
So actuarially sound means basically it won't bust the budget.
Right. Well, no, it won't. I guess I'll leave it at that.
So why is it still set at 2006? I mean, most companies, you know, try and give their workers at least a raise that keeps pace with inflation. So I'm just wondering how you resolve those workforce shortage issues that you guys both talked about, paying people, you know, the rates that they were paid 12 years ago. My goodness.
It's a significant concern. And again, we're making steps to look at those rates and to do what we can to increase them. When times were tough in 2008 and beyond, it was one place where there was some leeway to be able to reduce rates, and we need to get back and build those back up. One thing I do want to mention based on the workforce issue is the student loan repayment program has been very successful in helping us recruit and retain qualified staff for the community mental health system. And the recent efforts by the legislature, soon to be signed by Governor Lynch, by Governor Sununu, will invest another $700,000 into that program. So there is recognition there that there needs to be the workforce and qualified.
So if a young person goes into the mental health field, they will get some level of student debt reimbursement? Katya, how's that going to work?
So it works. It's a program that someone, once they're placed, they get repayment of their student debt over a period of time, and they make a commitment to stay with that particular program.
All right. I want to remind our listeners that you can join us today in The Exchange. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Today, The Exchange goes in-depth with a look at mental health care in New Hampshire. This is the first of four shows that we're going to do this week. We're beginning with an overview of the major components of our mental health system, where it works, where the holes are. Later on in the hour, it's our Race for the First series with Democrat 1st Congressional District candidate Mark McKenzie. Let's get your questions and comments in now, though, about the mental health system here in New Hampshire. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. And both of you, I want to bring another voice into our conversation. Andrew Milne is on the line, staff attorney with the Disability Rights Center of New Hampshire. That's the group that brought that lawsuit several years ago that I mentioned at the beginning of the show that ended in a settlement and a commitment to make the mental health system better. Andrew Milne, thank you very much for being with us. We appreciate it.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me.
What was the bottom line, Andrew, of this lawsuit that your organization brought? The biggest problem that you guys saw in terms of the rights of Granite Staters with mental illness?
The biggest problem, the bottom line, is unnecessary institutionalization, meaning that, and this is a standard that comes from the Americans with Disabilities Act, where the Supreme Court has interpreted the ADA to mean that people with disabilities who could be living integrated lives in the community, but instead are receiving treatment in institutional facilities like the state hospital or the state nursing home, they are unnecessarily segregated, and that's a form of discrimination under the ADA. So the intent of the lawsuit was to assert those rights to receive community-based treatment where appropriate. And the United States Department of Justice joined in our suit to represent its interest in enforcing that federal anti-discrimination law.
So it was sort of a form of segregation almost, not providing people the treatment in the communities where they could be living, you know, near or with friends and family, working perhaps. It was this more segregation, yes, in these large institutions.
Exactly.
So what do you think is better, Andrew? You know, it's been almost 5 years since this thing was signed.
Yeah, so there have been some really important concrete benefits to that class of individuals at risk of unnecessary institutionalization. I'd love to briefly mention a couple of them, as well as where there are still areas of improvement. Mobile crisis response has been a big benefit in the three communities where that has been implemented, as well as supported housing throughout the state. The mobile crisis is where a person in a mental health crisis can get help from a qualified professional, either in person or by phone, within an hour of contact, and to help diffuse the crisis and avoid hospitalization. And teams can also refer folks in crisis to crisis apartments where they can stay for up to a week. And those are based in the community rather than the hospital. But we'd love to see this mobile crisis model go statewide, as I know.
Yeah, where is that? I remember hearing about that model, and people were excited about it, and there were going to be pilots in Manchester and Concord. Where does that stand now, Andrew?
So in terms of statewide implementation of mobile crisis, I don't know that there is any really effort on the legislative or policy side to make that happen. The legislature did authorize funding for a fourth mobile team that would be in another area of the state with a high rate of admissions to New Hampshire Hospital. And that hasn't happened either. We've apparently there were some obstacles to getting bids to make that happen, and we've advocated for some solutions or some ways to try to overcome those barriers and move toward the expansion of mobile crisis rather than, say, like a site-based crisis treatment center where people who are in mental health crisis would be expected to get themselves to a facility that might be very far away in order to present for care.
Another big hole that your group identified, Andrew, is housing. Again, instead of segregating people, getting people integrated into the community. And as you know, there's a huge housing shortage in general in New Hampshire.
Right.
What do you see when you look at the housing situation and your particular efforts to get people struggling with mental illness living in the community, in housing?
So we've seen an expansion of supported housing for people with mental illness thanks to the community mental health agreement. Hundreds of people have received that benefit where they get money toward an apartment in the community rather than in a segregated facility or congregate housing. But there have been funding limitations and eligibility limitations that mean that there are still a lot of people who really need supported housing and aren't able to receive it. And the state has been expanding transitional housing a lot, which I think is very important to distinguish from supported housing. Because supported housing is permanent with tenancy rights and it's scattered site rather than congregate housing.
Congregate is everybody living, lots of people living in one place?
Yeah, well, lots of people with mental health diagnoses who have been recently discharged from the hospital. That's more transitional housing where
sure.
It's a more restricted setting. It's a lot of the transitional housing is actually on the campus of New Hampshire Hospital, and it's not integrated in the community, meaning that folks who are living in transitional housing are not living in regular apartments with all kinds of people. Rather, it's all folks who have been hospitalized and are coming out of that.
That's an important piece of the puzzle,
but it's not the solution that we really need in order to help people maintain be integrated in the community and stay out of the hospital.
Yeah, so it's not that integration that you want. It's sort of a continuation of the segregation that brought you to bring this lawsuit in the first place. Andrew Milne, I have to wrap you up there. I really appreciate you being with us. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having us. And thanks for doing the series.
Andrew Milne, staff attorney with the Disability Rights Center of New Hampshire. Now, coming up, we'll start taking your questions and comments. So send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. We'll also talk about the role of the private sector, especially private insurers and private hospitals, their role in improving the state's mental health system. All that's coming up, so stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, we go in-depth, spending the week on the state's mental health system. This hour, it's an overview of how it works, who's involved, where the gaps are. Send us an email with your questions and comments, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Again, today, it's an overview of the state's mental health system and what is better, what is not, since a major legal settlement was signed almost 5 years ago. Tomorrow, we'll focus on youth and children. Wednesday, the intersection between the mental health system and the criminal justice system. And then on Thursday, we'll focus more closely on this issue of New Hampshire Hospital and its role. Join us now again with your questions and comments, 1-800-892-6477. And Katya Fox, Ken Norton, let's go to our listeners. Dan is in Nashua. Dan, thank you for calling in. Go ahead.
Thanks so much. I just wanted to convey a word of appreciation to the Disability Rights Center and all those who've been advocating on behalf of people with mental disabilities. A close family member of mine was institutionalized in the Concord State Hospital, the New Hampshire State Hospital in Concord, for a decade. And throughout that time, we tried very much to have him at least transitioned out to a more supportive community setting, a more integrated setting. And that finally happened about 5 years ago, and we have to believe it was as a direct or indirect result of the lawsuit that this dear family member was able to make that big transition and start building some semblance of a normal life. It's not an easy path. It takes a long time, but to have so many years essentially lost, institutionalized, was very painful for everyone involved, and I'm grateful that we've made at least some progress, and grateful also for the leadership that the former Chief Justice John Broderick has shown in really hitting the streets and bringing this message to countless people.
So wow. Dan, what a story. Thank you so much for calling. And I'm sure Andrew Milne is still listening from the Disability Rights Center and heard your praise. So thank you for the call. So he talked about New Hampshire Hospital, the struggle to get his loved one into community-based housing, where, as Andrew explained, it's just better for the person. What do you think about this, Katya?
I think that it brings up a really good point that there are individuals at New Hampshire Hospital, and I know you're going to be talking more about this on Thursday, who, but for the supports in the community and the housing availability, would be able to live in an integrated setting. And an integrated setting means that people aren't isolated, and so that all individuals with severe mental illness are in one spot, that they're integrated just like anybody else into the community, and making choices about where they live and with whom they live and what type of setting. So we have a request for applications out that is, I believe the applications are due today, to look at community residences, which are an ability to set up those supports in a apartment or housing like a house-like setting that is for four or less individuals. And these are specifically designed for individuals coming out of New Hampshire Hospital so that they can achieve the success that was just described by the caller.
Well, and Dan, thank you again for the call. And I'm glad your story ended up well, although it took a long time. Ken, one of you mentioned earlier the issue of stigma. And you and I have talked about this a lot before. Stigma often comes up with mental illness. How hard is it to find these community housing places, given the stigma that mental illness has? It's hard enough to find housing for anyone in New Hampshire, but I wonder especially for this group of people.
I think it's still very difficult, and I think that there are
There's a fear factor, isn't there?
Yeah, there absolutely is. And, you know, when you hear New Hampshire Hospital or you hear, like, Dan's family member that had been there for a period of time, then that raises that fear factor or, you know, that feeling like, well, I don't want to be renting to this person, or I don't want this person living next door to me, or what if, you know, what if?
What if what?
Yeah. Well, whatever. I mean, people's, you know, it's again the conundrum about mental illness, and what we read in the media are those sensational stories, and what we don't read about are those successful stories like Dan's family member that go back and lead lives that are productive and, you know, in their communities. That's much harder to see.
And the reality is, these are people who are living with us already. You know, we always act as if they're not already here. Well, I don't want them living next to me. Well, they're here because they're your family members, they're your neighbors, and so it's actually quite puzzling to me. we need to put faces to this issue.
Which is, again, part of the effort that former Chief Justice Broderick is doing. Again, Dan and Ashwa, great to hear from you. You can join us, too. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call like Dan did, 1-800-892-6477. I want to bring another person into our conversation, both of you. On the line with us is Steve Annen, president of the New Hampshire Hospital Association. And Steve, welcome back. Good to have you on the show.
Good morning.
So what is the private hospital sector's role in improving New Hampshire's mental health system, Steve, given that now, you know, hospitals aren't just that standalone building, the hospital, but they really are running, you know, healthcare systems in their communities. So what's your role in all this?
Well, certainly hospitals have seen the challenge facing these patients on a daily basis, you know, given the fact that we've had a wait list for certainly almost as long as I've been in New Hampshire, which is almost 10 years now. The challenge is tremendous, and hospitals are working very, very hard in collaboration with their community mental health centers and with others to try and make sure that patients who are waiting in the ED are stabilized and that they're safe and that they are able to move as quickly as they can to the state hospital. I think what really this points to is there's simply a lack of capacity in the overall health system, behavioral health system here in New Hampshire to treat patients with an acute psychiatric crisis. And, you know, we have to do so many things. And as your guests there have already talked about, there have been a number of things that have occurred over the last couple of years. And I think it's due to a lot of their leadership and others. You know, I think it was about a year ago, Concord Hospital hosted several visits with key leaders, including the governor, the commissioner, Senate president, and others, to visit the emergency department at Concord Hospital to see firsthand what it means for a patient to be waiting in the emergency department before getting the care that they need at an acute psychiatric hospital.
Yeah, often makes the situation worse hanging out in the emergency room or the ED, as you call it.
Exactly, and certainly hospitals are working very hard on new modalities, early directed therapy, and other types of things to help patients who are there. But again, how do we avoid people needing those services? I've heard you talk about the sort of community action teams, mobile crisis teams, and other things are absolutely essential. We have to find ways to expand capacity throughout the system, not just in terms of the inpatient capacity, but we do need more inpatient capacity because there are people who will need those services at some time. But as Katja and others have just talked about, we need to make certain that we can move people out of the hospital into a more appropriate setting, opening up additional capacity at the state hospital. I think there's a lot of work that's going on, and as I've testified before the legislature, there isn't just one thing that we have to do. We have to do everything, and we have to do it now. We have to find a way to put additional resources. The legislature and governor have been tremendous in helping to move this along, but we need to do more. We need to increase, as you talked about earlier, increase rates for the community behavioral health centers, increase rates for hospitals that run the involuntary facilities that they do run so that they are sustainable, so that they can attract the workforce, so that they can maintain those services now and in the long term. Again, we've got a lot to do. I'm optimistic, but again, we have more work to do.
And Steve, let me jump in on you, if I could, for just a moment, please. So a couple years ago, more like 5, 6, 7 years ago, emergency room docs really brought this issue to the forefront, saying, look, you know, we're supposed to be treating victims of car crashes and people with broken legs, and we have people in a mental health crisis waiting in our emergency rooms for hours and hours, if not days and days. How is that situation now? Has the sort of daily number of people waiting in a mental health crisis, how has that improved? Are we still seeing large numbers of people in that situation?
We still have large numbers of people. At the end of last week, we had 39 adults in emergency rooms and 3 children in emergency rooms around the state. And Ken and I participated in a press conference that he and NAMI organized a number of years ago. And at the time, we were talking about 10 to 20 patients a day. And now, you know, we're talking about 40 to 50, sometimes even more patients a day. So again, we've made progress. Some of it is not always visible, but we have much more work to do in order to stem this crisis. And again, I feel confident that we have a number of leaders in place. The new CEO at the hospital, Lori Chibonet, has been incredibly helpful. And I think one of the things that we can do, and we've been trying to do through the association, is to become better partners and partners with the state hospital, with the community mental health centers, and others, so that we are working together to solve this problem. And it's not just the state hospital over here and the community hospitals over here, but really trying to look at this from a systems perspective.
So let me ask about that partnership, Steve. And there has been some criticism that hospitals themselves used to be more partners in this, but that over the past decade or two, they've closed their psychiatric units for business reasons. It just didn't bring in enough cash, contributing to what we see today. So I wonder if, you know, you guys have been part of the problem by closing these units, reducing that capacity.
Actually, Laura, there are actually more private psychiatric beds in the state today than there were back in 2011. They may not always all be in the same place, and there are economic challenges that do face organizations, and you know, the reimbursement rates that are offered for these services often are far less than the cost of providing the service. You've talked about the workforce challenges that we face. And so there are significant challenges. And as I said, we've got more work to do. We've added resources. But again, I think we have much more that needs to be done if we're going to create a sustainable system over time. And hospitals certainly have been a part of the solution, and we want to continue to be part of the solution.
Well, Steve, thank you very much for being with us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Laura.
That's Steve Onnen, president of the New Hampshire Hospital Association. Again, talking about the role of the private sector in this issue of New Hampshire's mental health system. We're looking at how it's been working, some of the improvements, a lot of the gaps. We'd love to hear from you, 1-800-892-6477. Katya, in addition to the emergency room issue, and we've talked about that with Steve Onnen, the state itself has come under criticism for improperly transferring some people with mental illness, not to the state hospital, but to the state prison, including people who haven't committed a crime. This is the conversation. It's a bigger conversation than we'll have time for today about the secure psychiatric unit of the prison. At the prison, how is the state addressing that concern that some people aren't being appropriately moved to the psychiatric unit in the prison?
I am going to punt on this one. I think that's an area that is being debated and has been for years in the legislature. And I really think that the conversation is ongoing. I know that there was recent legislation that has to do with the Department of Corrections on that very issue. And so I think that's ongoing.
Is that a policymaker decision, though, like a legislative decision and not so much a nuts and bolts at the DHHS level decision? I'm just wondering who makes those decisions.
I think it's more complicated than just one or the other.
Do you want to jump in on that, Ken?
Sure.
That's been a big issue in the media anyway.
You know, I mean, 30 years ago, the secure psychiatric unit was in the main building at New Hampshire Hospital.
Really?
Yes. And, you know, and at a point in time, the legislature decided to move it to the prison. There was a lot of political pressure at the time relative to the community not wanting it necessarily where it was on Pleasant Street. There had been some incidents that occurred there. So it came under the auspices of the Department of Corrections. And at that point in time, then there was this gap between some people who are not able to be managed at New Hampshire Hospital because of their safety or the safety of others, who then end up being transferred to the secure psychiatric unit.
I see. So, and this predates my time hosting the show. So, and it's interesting because I actually live in the neighborhood of New Hampshire Hospital. So the area around there, some people said, boy, these, you know, people who seem to have a lot of issues, we don't feel safe and we want them put the secure psychiatric unit put in the Department of Corrections so that we don't have to worry that these folks will escape and do bad things. That's
part of it.
That's the oversimplified version.
There were a couple of high profile escapes that, you know, that resulted in tragedies.
Okay. And so it was a political decision, a policy decision, as Katya said, to move it over to the Corrections Department. And now we have the situation where some people feel like it's being overused and that it's not a medical facility, even though people have a medical problem, a mental illness problem.
Well, it's commingling prisoners with people who aren't prisoners, and that, you know, and that's problematic. And, you know, and families have to go through correctional visitation requirements that they would not have to go through if the person was at New Hampshire Hospital.
Well, and maybe we'll touch more on that on Wednesday when we look at the intersection of the criminal justice system and the mental health system. A couple more questions for all of you before we wrap up. And Ken, to you first, we've talked so much on this program about the state's opioid crisis, and I wonder what links you see between the problems in the mental health system and the opioid crisis.
Well, there's a lot of links, and you know, and this maybe gets back to the questions with Steve about the hospitals and overall, looking at people as whole people and not as segregated. You know, they're going to get their mental health treatment here, they're going to get their drug misuse treatment here, they're going to get their physical health treatment here. You know, at the extreme end of things, obviously the connection between drug overdose deaths and suicide is something that ultimately the medical examiner sorts out, and that disregard for life or what are being described as deaths of despair. And you know, and the bigger piece, I think, is that with opioids, with mental illness, there is a very high co-occurrence of physical disorders. So people that have pain or have other physical health medical conditions, and the overlap between mental illness and substance misuse is very high there.
So do you think that that we've spent too much time focusing on opioids, and money from the feds and money from the state to the detriment of the mental health system?
No, I mean, I think that the opioid crisis is a huge crisis, and you know, and people are dying, but not just dying. People are, you know, less visibly having problems, children ending up in foster care, or people being unable to parent, or, you know, or people's parents ending up caring for their children, so grandparents running families. The problems are huge, and employers feel it. We really, I think we've done a good job trying to address the complexities of a very challenging problem.
Katya, you mentioned earlier in the program about a new 10-year plan. We don't have time to go into all the questions that I have about this, but I guess my main question is, why do we need a new 10-year plan?
So if we look at the plan from 2008.
It's a long time ago.
It was a long time ago. There are some pieces in there that we did not implement. And one is some of the group housing that was referenced earlier by Andrew, the group homes. So what we have the opportunity to do and why we need a new plan is because there have been many new models that have emerged, like mobile crisis, like the urgent care center for behavioral health that was referenced by Andrew earlier as well. And those are the types of models and practices that we want to be able to implement in New Hampshire.
All right, both of you, we barely scratched the surface, but we've got all the rest of the week to look at New Hampshire's mental health system more in depth. I want to thank both of you very much for being here. Thank you. That's Katya Fox, Director of the Division for Behavioral Health at DHHS, and Ken Norton, Executive Director of NAMI-NH. Coming up, we continue our Race for the First series. Every Monday, we're meeting one of the many candidates for the first congressional district. Up next is Democrat Mark McKenzie. You can listen to our interview and watch it on Facebook Live. So go to NHPR's Facebook page. You'll find it there. All that's coming up, so stay with us.
I've been an NHPR member for just about 20 years, and this year I decided to become a sustaining member.
Nancy DeBosque of Keene.
I think NHPR has tremendous value, and it's local, so I really do like to know what's going on in my state and use that information a lot in my work.
Thousands of listeners like Nancy support NHPR with ongoing monthly contributions, and you can too. Invest in independent local news and become a sustainer today at nhpr.org and click on donate.
This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy. It's our Race for the First series. Each Monday, we introduce you to a candidate running for New Hampshire's first congressional district. It's an open seat in a swing district, so there are many contenders vying for their party's nomination. At last count, 3 Republicans and 9 Democrats. Our candidate today is one of those Democrats, Mark McKenzie. He's a state representative from Manchester, a former firefighter, and former head of the New Hampshire AFL-CIO. And Representative McKenzie, welcome back. Good to see you.
Yeah, thank you. Good to see you as well.
And Exchange listeners, let's get you involved, especially if you live in the 1st District. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org, exchange@nhpr.org. Facebook or Twitter is NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. You can also watch our interview today on Facebook Live. So, Representative McKenzie, we're on the 6th floor here in our building.
That's
so,
right.
You know, a little
nice
bit of an
place.
Elevator ride. Give us the 30-second elevator speech of why 1st District voters listening right now should pick you.
Mark McKenzie is a seasoned leader with a record of accomplishments. I'm a strong voice for working families, and I've done that all my life. And I can win this thing because the people of New Hampshire want somebody that's a fighter and somebody's going to stand up and fight for them.
Well, and I definitely want to ask about your long time working as a union activist. But first, Representative McKenzie, it just defies imagination that there's been yet another school shooting in Texas shortly after Parkland, Florida. The nation has been debating how to stop this rise in mass shootings, and not just schools, but, you know, churches, movies, shopping malls, all sorts of places where we all just go out and gather. What type of approach would a Congressman McKenzie support for this?
Well, we know there's too many weapons in the society today. And I think that what's always got in the way of any kind of reform in this country is the whole question of money and the ability of us to overcome the money to get to the place where we can actually make good reforms. The idea that people are using weapons, getting weapons, and using them in a violent way is unacceptable. In spite of this, the Second Amendment and all of the people who are defending that, I understand it. But we have a right, people have a right in this country, to have a discussion about our safety, about the safety of our children, about the safety of our country. And weapons should not be in circulation. They aren't licensed. People shouldn't be using them. They have not passed a background check, and I believe in that. So
get specific if you could, please. So sort of 1, 2, 3. If you were in Congress, what would you push for?
I would push for certainly for background checks.
Universal, everywhere. Even if it's person-to-person sales, internet sales,
absolutely.
Everything.
Get away from the idea that you're using, you're in gun shows and you're able to do that, you're doing it over the internet. We'd get rid of all that. We'd pass laws that would take weapons that were never intended to be they were military weapons. They're never intended to be in circulation, and we really got to come up with the idea of banning those weapons in our society. And finally, the whole question about how we're going to remediate this in the long run. You know, I think we're going to have to. We're going to have to come together as a group of people and say very clearly that that we want to have a serious discussion on this. We want to make sure that that people are going to be safe going forward. And I think that those are the education piece, making sure the weapons are locked down so people don't have access to them that don't belong to it. But in general, there's too many weapons in our society.
And we could talk for the next 15 minutes about this. And I know your campaign is about a lot more. But when you talk about banning certain types of weapons, even if you banned those tomorrow, there's a lot of them out there. So, like, what do you do if somebody owns one of these? Do you go to their house and take it away? I mean, that's not very politically feasible.
Well, you're not going to take. I'm not going to take somebody's gun away. That's not what the Second Amendment says. But I think we can start the process of controlling those kinds of weapons and how they're used and where they show up in our society. And we got to come up. We have to have a conversation about whether or not the weapons that are currently in place should be there. And let's have a discussion about that. We don't discuss, because every time we go to discuss this, the NRA or somebody else jumps into it, throws a bag of money at the problem, raises all this money, and it really comes down to that. People want to be safe, and that's what people want. If these guns are contributing to an unsafe society, then we have to take that into consideration. I'm for any reasonable gun controls in this country. Reasonable. That's what I would do. That's the approach that I would take. With these kinds of things.
Well, again, we could talk a lot more about this, Representative McKenzie, but I did want to talk about a couple other big issues for your campaign in particular. You spent a lifetime as a union activist. You were a fireman, a leader of the AFL-CIO in New Hampshire for many years. You've been a state lawmaker for one term. What's different about being a state lawmaker versus being a labor leader?
Well, in some ways, it's a continuation of the work that I've done. I have always been fighting for workers and working families. And being in the state legislature gave me the opportunity to continue that work, which is what I would do in the Congress of the United States. I think that you have to, in a very big legislative building like that, and I was a rookie, but what we were able to do is to contribute to the discussion around family leave, to make sure that we had a good discussion about that, to talk about guns, to talk about issues that affect people, working families in the state. And that's to be on the inside of that, have that discussion, it's been a very interesting process for me. Very different than being an advocate.
Did you work with Republicans in the state house? Any bipartisan legislation you want to tell us about?
Well, there wasn't a whole lot of bipartisan going on up there this particular year. But, you know, I worked on a labor committee. The labor committee was predominantly Republicans. We got some things done up there. And I think that's what I'll do. You know, my whole history has been with working Democrats and Republicans. You don't beat the right to work 17 times if you don't work with Democrats and Republicans. And that's my history.
Well, and let's talk about that a little bit more. You have said, a couple times already that you are sort of for the working guy or gal. As you know, President Trump won the Oval Office in part because of his success among white working class voters. What did the president get about this group of voters that Democrats didn't?
Well, I think the Democrats have forgot the fact of who they are. And I often say to Democrats, you know, do your elevator speech like you asked me when I came here. Who are you? Who are the Democrats? What do you stand for? And the Democrats have got to define that. Because if the Democrats aren't the party of the working families, then the Democrats are going to continue to lose elections going forward. And the other thing, you can't allow money to infiltrate the Democratic Party. It's getting increasingly more expensive to run for office now, which is a big problem. And you can't allow the Democratic Party to be corrupted by money, and you have to stand your ground in terms of that. You know, my dad, when I was 5 years old, I was driving signs in the ground with him. And I said, well, we're working for Dick Van Dole. He's running for city council. I said, what do we do? He's a Democrat, my father said. And he said, the Democrats are the party of the working families. And I always remembered that. And it's in my head, and that's who we should be.
So what does that mean exactly, Representative McKenzie, the working families? I mean, are bankers in this group? Are lawyers in this group? I mean, who's in this group of, quote unquote, working families and who isn't?
You know, I think we have common ground in a lot of issues, whether you're Democrat or Republican. I think everybody wants to make sure that they can participate in the society, that they can find good work, that they can find good jobs, that they have pensions, that they have health care, which is something has dogged us for years. All of these things I have fought for and worked on throughout the time. Issues like college, you know, the kind of money people are paying for college right now.
Yeah, I'm in that situation myself, I understand. Yeah.
Right, so it's all
a
about,
lot of money.
Yeah, there's some basic issues. I call it common ground, these basic issues that people need to... You know, we're on the same page in a lot of this.
Well, and talking about money invading the Democratic Party, as you put it, and that's part of the reason you've said that the Democratic Party isn't seen as the party of working people. As you know, Representative McKenzie, unions contribute to politics a fair bit of money, too. So square that up for us. What's the difference there?
The difference is the way that labor gets money. Workers give a nickel or a dime per hour in their work there. So any kind of political action money is really the nickels and dimes of working families, as opposed to the corporation. The corporation is dropping thousands of dollars into a campaign. They have a very different set of values than the working families that I've represented. They're peeling off $5,000, in campaigns, maxing out on different campaigns, investing a tremendous amount of money, independent expenditures. It's out of control.
So this is a broader base, you're saying, of contributions.
That's, well, yeah. I mean, it's a very different group of people. I mean, any money anybody contributes to me, the nickels and dimes, are to make their lives better. I'm not sure that that's necessarily the focus of corporate America right now, to make people's lives better, to make their lives better.
I want to ask you about a couple more quick issues that I know have been important to you, Representative McKenzie, over your career. You've been a big critic of the North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA. You got a friend in the White House on that issue. Anyway, the president also does not like this treaty. But a lot of analysts say that, you know, it's oversimplifying it to say that this has been bad for American workers, that really automation is the biggest reason why. manufacturing jobs have gone away. What do you think? Are you barking up the wrong tree here with NAFTA? Is it really the boogeyman that you say it is?
Well, had NAFTA had NAFTA enforced some of the laws that were in the trade agreements, they never did. That's the trouble with trade agreements, that you put all of this stuff in, you go to foreign countries, and nobody endorses it, nobody supports it, nobody worries about what people are making. And I think consumers have responded to that. But automation certainly has invaded the workspace, but it made people more productive in the long run, but it hasn't contributed in any way to raising wages in this country. And it hasn't done anything to lower the number of hours that people work on a daily basis. So, you know, there should be some reward for increased, if automation is going forward, there should be some reward for, that workers get when, for automation of a higher productivity. It just doesn't happen in this country.
Many union workers here in New Hampshire, including the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, were behind the Northern Pass project, which, as you know, was rejected by the state's site evaluation committee. Where did you come down on Northern Pass, given your stated concern about the environment, and environmental groups were really against this thing, but given your longtime activism with unions?
Well, the Northern Pass went through the regulatory process, and I had nothing to do with that. I mean, that was decided by in the regulatory process. You know, the Northern Pass would have provided hundreds and hundreds of jobs to people, union workers and other people. But the real question, whether it be the Northern Pass or anything else in this country, is where are we going in terms of the future of energy in this country? And I think that we've got to come up with a solution to that. We've got to get both the environmentalists and the unions and other concerned people in a room and figure out how we're going to get away from fossil fuels, how we're going to move forward, how we're going to engage new energy sources in this country. And we don't do that. Everybody fights each other.
And you have said, I heard you say on WMUR recently, that the country needs to get off of fossil fuels. They're ruining our world. To quote you there, would Northern Pass have been a good way to towards that goal of getting off fossil fuels?
Again, I think that's a regulatory environment. Those are the people who make those kinds of decisions. And, you know, they made a decision that Northern Pass was not a good fit for the state of New Hampshire. And they know a whole lot more about that than I do. And so for me, it's about energy sources, about new energy sources, about renewable energies, and weaning ourselves off of fossil fuels. That's where I'm going in this. And that's how I will approach a number of these things.
So it sounds like you're a little uncomfortable saying yes or no on Northern Pass.
What I'm saying to you is the same thing I've said to everybody that's ever asked me about it. Northern Pass would have provided a lot of jobs and opportunity for the people I represented. But the environmentalists opposed it, and the regulatory people opposed it, and they've made the decision about this.
So getting off fossil fuels, again, as you have said, one of the ideas often cited, I'm sure you've heard of this, Representative McKenzie, is to impose a carbon tax on all forms of carbon. This is often, by economists anyway, they say this is a quick and direct way to wean ourselves off fossil fuels, make them expensive, it spurs innovation. That's the idea anyway. But this approach could hurt the working people you say you've been fighting for. So I wonder what you think about a carbon tax.
Well, I support carbon tax. I think it's a way to take away the incentives for the oil companies. But let me say this again. Everybody I've ever represented wants to work, and they'll work. They want to work. They would love to work in the new economy, the thermal and all of these wind and solar and all of these kinds of things. The problem we have now is there is no opportunity for that going forward. We can't seem to get on the same page between the environmentalists and labor and other people concerned and come up with an energy policy that keeps people working and helps them to work. And that's what we've got to do in this country.
So do you see yourself, Representative McKenzie, as kind of providing that intersection between environmentalists and union activists who have, as you point out, sometimes been at odds over these projects and policy ideas?
Well, I think I'm one of the few people, if the only person in this race, that has the kind of experience with mediation and fact-finding and working with people and building coalitions. And so I think I come with a lot of skills to this thing. And that's what's important to me, and that's what I bring to this race.
Well, and speaking of working and most people wanting to work and make a decent wage, you and most Democrats support raising the minimum wage. By how much, Representative McKenzie?
Well, I have two things. I think it should be $15 an hour. And the other thing I think we should do is eliminate the subminimum wage, which is paid to people in various occupations in this country. People who are disabled get subminimum wage. Restaurant workers get subminimum wage. I think we should eliminate that. I think everybody should be on par. They should be getting a minimum wage. It should be $15 an hour. It's a single thing, biggest thing we can do to change our economy and to change the direction for many, many people's lives.
Could a $15 minimum wage end up being a wash for a lot of people in that companies will just increase their prices? So, sure, you're making more money, but everything's more expensive. So there's an inflationary
You have the opportunity for people. People are making minimum wage of spending money. So employers need to understand that it is in the best interest of everybody to be able to put more money in the economy, grow the economy, and allow people to participate. And I think that I think employers miss that a lot of times. I think there's an opportunity to actually do that. And that's why I've always supported the increase in minimum wage.
Well, Representative McKenzie, I want to close out with a political question. Some younger Democrats are saying, you know, Nancy Pelosi in the House, Chuck Schumer in the Senate, you know, thank you very much. Time for a new generation. Time for a refresh, a reboot of party leadership in Washington. What do you think?
You know, excuse me, I'm trying to get elected. And that's really what's on my screen right now. So who the Speaker of the House was, that may never be anything I ever decide. But
so first things first, you're
first
saying?
First things first. Let's get elected.
Well, okay, so last question on that. You're one of nine Democrats. Wow, nine Democrats running for the party's nomination in the 1st Congressional District. You sort of gave the pitch, here's why I'm running. But why should 1st District voters pick you over a Terrence O'Rourke, a Lincoln Soldati, a Mindy Mesmer, a Chris Pappas who will join us next week? Why you over the other eight?
Because I have a record of accomplishments. I've been on the ground doing this work. I've been a change agent for a lot of years. I'm very accomplished at it. I know how to do it. I know how to get it done. Nobody in this race has anywhere near the experience I have in terms of politics and getting things done and building coalitions and working grievances and all of that stuff that you need to do to be successful. I'm the best one in this race to do it.
All right. Representative McKenzie, time goes fast. Thank you very much for being here. I really appreciate it. That's Mark McKenzie, again, a longtime labor activist, a Democratic state representative running for the 1st Congressional District here in New Hampshire. Our Race for the First series continues next Monday at this time. Our candidate will be Democratic Executive Counselor Chris Pappas. Go to our website for more information about this series, who's been on, who's coming up, and to watch and listen to past interviews. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.